This is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Mark Neutbar in for Kevin Gavin. Coming up later in the show, the air is better in Allegheny County than it was just a few decades ago, but it's still not great, especially in places where incomes are lower. And a water authority in the region is thinking about dropping fluoride from the list of chemicals it adds to drinking water. But first, over the years, Pittsburgh City Council has tried to encourage social change through legislation. It has done the same to move forward other ideas that are more liberal than much of the rest of the state, including laws on gun control. But often those laws have been struck down by the courts or negated by the state legislature, in part because Pittsburgh is a city of the second class. That's not just a pejorative term, it's a legal term. Joining me now is Bob Bowder of the Tribune Review and Rebecca Addison from the City Paper. Thanks for joining me, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
So this idea of a city of the second class, is that something you guys talk about all the time?
Not really.
So the quick primer of it is it goes all the way back to 1901, where they said we need these different classes of cities. A city of the second class is between 250,000 and 1 million people. It sets out several different things. The mayor shall be the chief executive officer of the city, has to be 25 years of age. It even says which departments the city needs to have, and that the Department of Public Safety shall be under the charge of one director. And it lays out some more of those different departments in some specificity. And then it even talks about what the city can and cannot do when it comes to passing legislation. Pittsburgh is the only city of the second class. Scranton is 2A. And Philadelphia is only city of the first class. So now on to a few specifics about this. Most recently, the city lost a court battle over residency requirements for police. The dispute began back in 2012 when the state legislature repealed a residency mandate requiring officers of the second-class cities to live within city limits. Can one of you take me back and kind of run through the history of how this came to be? Bob?
Well, you mean how the history of how that
The city requirement to live in the city for police officers.
Well, it was an act of the legislature, and it's the city employees have been required to live in the city for more than a century. It goes back to the turn of the century, and it probably was for revenue. You know, you're working for the city, so they felt you should pay city taxes.
Now, the city said, we're going to keep our police officers here, but then the state Supreme Court stepped in, correct?
Well, first, there was a change in the state law that triggered all this. The law previously said police shall live in the city, and it was changed to say they may live in the city, and that opened it up to collective bargaining. And the police union, the Fraternal Order of Police, and the city reached a standstill, so they asked for arbitration. And arbitrators ruled in favor of the FOP. And that led to the court battle. The city appealed that. It went to the Supreme Court, and they lost at the Supreme Court.
And what the FOP was saying is within 25 miles of the point, I believe?
That's what the arbitration panel said. Okay. The arbitrators ruled that police officers could live within 25 air miles of the city county building, which is on Grant Street downtown.
So this takes away a bargaining chip then when the city is dealing with the police, right?
That's right.
So the city of Philadelphia has this as part of their contract, that the police must live within the municipality. Now it's something that it doesn't really seem like the city of Pittsburgh has as a bargaining chip. It's now back to the FOP having the powers. Am I understanding this correctly?
That's right.
Absolutely. So before we get into some more specific pieces of legislation, and when we talk about is the city overreaching or is the state overburdening or is Philadelphia just its own little thing over there, the big news of the week, President Trump says the U.S. is getting out of the Paris Accord, and it's making and in making the announcement, he said, quote, "I was elected to represent the citizens of Pittsburgh, not Paris." Mayor Bill Peduto came out against the statement and quickly said this on CNN.
Pittsburgh will meet our 2023 goals. Pittsburgh will meet our 2030 goals. We'll still follow through.
So that is a way of him saying, you know, Pittsburgh is not a Trump fan. And what can the mayor actually do?
So I think what he can actually do is kind of what he has been doing. He issued his executive order this morning that basically says that Pittsburgh is going to continue to commit to addressing climate change locally. The executive order doesn't have, you know, doesn't place actual restrictions on anyone, but it does say that we're going to be committed to, you know, investing in renewable energy and trying to reduce emissions and things like that.
So is that enforceable, though? Can he really do this?
I mean, I think he can continue the commitment here to addressing climate change. He can't, you know, go around and make the same requirements that are in, obviously, the Paris Climate Accords here in Pittsburgh, but he can continue to do the things that we're already doing, like the city's 2030 climate objectives.
Yeah. Now, Bob, part of this would probably be taking it outside of just the city's endeavors and the city's actions and onto other businesses. Is that possible?
Well, the courts have ruled against several pieces of legislation recently that in which city council attempted to enforce regulations on private business. And the courts have ruled they couldn't do that. And it's because the Home Rule Charter, Pittsburgh's Home Rule Charter, says that the city cannot regulate private business. So the mayor can have the city operations reduce emissions and garbage by 100% over the next 30 years or so. But it probably will, it could run into trouble if he tries to force, say, a company operating in the city to do the same.
So let's talk about another example of what you were just talking about. Last month, the Commonwealth Court struck down a city law that, had it been allowed to be enacted, and it never really was, would have required businesses in the city to offer paid sick leave. What was that bill about?
Well, the council passed an ordinance in 2015 that said anyone working in the city had to offer their employees a certain amount of sick leave each year. And a group of restaurants, and mainly restaurants, took the city to court. They lost.
And so there was an injunction before it even was allowed to be enacted, correct?
Right, while the case went through the courts.
I have a little bit of the court opinion, and it said, quote, "A municipality which adopts a home rule charter shall not determine duties, responsibilities, or requirements placed upon businesses, occupations, or employers." Interesting note, though, the city of Philadelphia has one of these laws in place where it is almost exactly what the city of Pittsburgh was proposing. So I pose to you guys, does Philadelphia have an unfair advantage? Is this something that we should be talking about?
I mean, I think they have an unfair advantage. The other law that was recently struck down was the one that would require security officers in buildings to have a certain kind of training. You know, it seems like a good idea to require security officers to have CPR and that kind of training. But this was something that, again, was struck down in courts, passed by city council and then struck down in the courts. It seems like kind of, you know, a no-brainer. It might be good to have, but yeah, we are hampered in that we can't pass those kinds of laws.
So really the only remedy then is to go directly to the state legislature, right?
And so that's something I've heard, is that bills like this, while unenforceable, do send a message to the legislature that these are things that citizens in Pittsburgh want to see. And hopefully if enough cities pass these kinds of legislation, maybe it does send a message to the legislature that this is what we want to see.
Let's hold that thought about sending a message, and we're going to come back onto that. But, you know, the Pittsburgh region has a couple of very powerful state representatives. Mike Terzai is among them. Mike Terzai is a Republican, though, from the North Hills, the majority of the city of Pittsburgh, Democrats. Is the city of Pittsburgh ever really going to get the support it needs in Harrisburg?
Not unless our state reps reflect the population here.
All right. Do you see the city trying to do anything? Is there much out there?
I don't.
They've lobbied, you know, and they continuously do lobbying efforts in Harrisburg. The mayor and his chief of staff, Kevin Ackland, go there and talk to the local delegation and try to get favorable laws passed for the city. But Democrats are in a minority.
Right.
And have been for many years in Harrisburg.
And it might not change because of gerrymandering, but that's for a whole nother subject. I'm sure we'll have you back on that one. Now, you were talking about sending a message. There has been a lot of legislation that has come out of the city of Pittsburgh. Anything that comes to your mind before I throw you an example?
So what always comes to mind for me is the city's lost and stolen gun ordinance, which would require gun owners to report if their guns have been lost or stolen. This was passed under the under Luke Ravensall's administration. It was passed by council. Mayor Peduto had said during the campaign that when he came into office, he was actually going to enforce it and he didn't care if the city would be sued. There's an actual video of him saying that. And yet he has never enforced it. And that's because the city would be sued if anyone tried to fine a gun owner for not reporting their gun lost or stolen. So this is something that, as I was saying about sending a message, that gun violence organizations have said that, you know, even though we can't enforce this, if more cities pass this sends a message to the legislature that this is something we want to see enforced.
Now, I'm sorry, Bob, did you have something?
Well, the NRA also sued and successfully won a case where the municipality would have to pay legal costs for being sued for ordinance doing exactly what Rebecca just said. I just wanted to add that in there, that they could be held liable for that.
Go ahead.
There's also legislation. It's been called by locals in Pittsburgh the Punish Our Towns Bill, that even if a piece of legislation is not enforced, so even if no one ever gets fined, it would give people the right to sue cities that have passed this kind of legislation.
There was a piece of legislation that passed late last year that would prohibit mental health providers from doing anything in this conversion therapy arena. Bob, do you remember that legislation?
Yes, I do. That was championed by Council President Krause and Council Member Dan Gilman. And it passed, and it was signed by the mayor. In covering that story, though, I had talked to some people who said they were unaware of this ever happening in the city of Pittsburgh. So whether it does or doesn't, I'm not sure, but it's still on the books.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So, yeah, this is something that hasn't been challenged yet. But perhaps that is because in my reporting as well, I found that there were not very many examples of this this practice continuing in Pittsburgh.
Yeah. When I spoke to Bill Krause myself at that time, he said that it was important for council to take a stand on important political issues. Kind of what I read into that as the reporter on that story was that council should do this even if the law is never going to be enforced, isn't really needed, and if the state legislature is just going to kick it out or the state courts. Should we have an advocacy council, or should they just be focused on dealing with drinking water and things like that?
I think, you know, especially with things like paid sick leave, there are people that really believe in paid sick leave. So it's not enough for them to just see city council pass a piece of legislation that says that they support paid sick leave if it's never going to be enforced.
Again, Philadelphia has that piece of legislation. Philadelphia also has the ability to institute taxes that a city of the second class, Pittsburgh, does not, such as that sugary drink tax. It's also proposing a plastic bag tax. Now, that's something that the city of Pittsburgh could not do, but it doesn't really matter because it seems that the legislature is going to get rid of that. Now, I mentioned drinking water. Let's talk about perhaps the state reaching down to the city in ways that perhaps some say they shouldn't. The Pittsburgh Sewer and Water Authority. The legislation has been introduced by State Representative Mike Terzai, who I mentioned earlier in the program from the North Hills, and Harry Reedshaw of the South Hills. Now, Terzai is a Republican and Reedshaw is a Democrat, but Reedshaw says this is not about the state trying to take over the PWSA.
It's not like somebody saying, this is what you are going to do. You will have to go and basically get permission for whatever it is you may attempt to do.
Now, can either of you fill me in on a few of the details of what this legislation is in Harrisburg?
Well, it would give the PUC oversight of the Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority. And Mike Terzai has been on record in the past during the Ravenstahl administration as suggesting that the city should sell the PWSA asset and it should be privatized. And he's on record as a person who's in favor of privatization in other areas of government. He did not stipulate that the city should privatize PWSA, but he said that he felt it would benefit from PUC oversight, and the mayor has said he would support that.
So the Public Utility Commission would be just one more layer, so there would still be some local control?
Well, you still have a board of directors that oversees PWSA, and that's your local control, appointed by the mayor.
Do we think that this is going to be a fight, or is this just going to go off into the sunset?
Doesn't appear so. If it passes, it sounds from what city officials have said so far that they would accept it.
So when we talk about the state legislature enacting laws, which I should note that the state legislature cannot enact a law that singles out a single city, but it can enact a law that singles out a single class. So if you say a city is of the second class, what have you done? You've just singled out the city of Pittsburgh and the city of Pittsburgh alone. If you do that for the city of a first class, it's only Philadelphia. Now, so when we think about the state legislature doing that, when we think about that second class city code, and when we think about these advocacy pieces of legislation at the city council, are we seeing a pattern? Is there something that we can read in the tea leaves at all?
I mean, I think a lot of what city council has been doing is sending a message to their constituents and to the state that they support progressive initiatives like paid sick leave, like the Lawson stolen gun ordinance, and like the requirement for the security officers in buildings. So sending a message that they support these kinds of legislation, but maybe knowing full well that they can't enforce them.
And it comes at some cost. They have to, when sued and in both of the cases you've mentioned so far, or all three of them, it has cost the city money to defend those lawsuits.
And it seems as though these are not usually pieces of legislation that everybody on the city council is excited about. It's one or two individuals. Is that a fair assessment?
I would say that everyone on city council, with the exception of Darlene Harris, is pretty together on all of these things. I saw a lot of support for paid sick leave. Lawson Solon's a little far back for me to remember, but I've seen a lot of support. Again, city council has been passing a lot of legislation because they have a good quorum right now.
Yeah, I think the Lost and Stolen was a councilman who's no longer on the board. And I believe sick leave was Councilman O'Connor, if memory serves. I'm sure council and the state legislature is going to keep you guys busy with legislation that is both good and legislation that is maybe of another design. So thanks for coming in today. That was Bob Bowder, the Tribune Review, and Rebecca Addison of the City Paper. Thanks for coming in, guys.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks.
The Allegheny Front is diving into pollution and how it impacts some neighborhoods more than others. That and more when the confluence continues right here on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. Mayor Bill Peduto had some strong words for President Trump after he announced the U.S. will leave the Paris Climate Accord. Trump said Thursday, quote, "I was elected to represent the citizens of Pittsburgh, not Paris." Peduto said he was appalled the president would use a steel city to justify his decision. And a Pittsburgh musician remade Alanis Morissette's classic Ironic video, Shot for Shot. You can find the Homeless Gospel Choir's video and other top stories on WESA.FM.
It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Mark Newtbar in for Kevin Gavin. The Allegheny Front is launching a series of stories this weekend called Hazardous to Your Health. I did not live near the mills when they were pumping out smoke, but I have seen the pictures and read the stories. The region has received accolades, though, for cleaning up the air and water since then. But environmental health problems do persist in southwestern Pennsylvania. This series explores not only the broad problem caused by pollution, but it drills down to the individual communities that are most impacted. Joining me on the phone is Allegheny Front reporter Julie Grant. Julie, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Mark.
And in the studio is Reed Frazier. Reed, thanks.
Hi, Mark.
Lady and gentlemen, help me understand, what was the birth of this series?
Well, I think, just broadly speaking, you know, we're kind of taking a closer look at maybe some environmental issues that we all kind of take for granted. And, maybe they're just sort of under the radar. And we just kind of live with them every day, and trying to take a fresh look at these and saying, okay, is this how we should be doing things, regulating industries, situating pollution? A big chunk of this is something that we'll talk about later, but environmental justice. Are certain communities more exposed to the pollution that we create to create all the products that we use than others? And is that fair?
And we have go ahead, Julie.
Sorry. We wanted to see, like, what kind of evidence is there out there really to show that what we're being exposed to every day in the environment in terms of pollution and other things, what does that mean for our health? And as Reed was just alluding to, what happens when you live in a community where, say, you depend on the jobs from industry, but then you also have to live with the pollution, and that pollution may be, harming your health, and what can you do there? And that's sort of what we're calling environmental justice issues, when there's not much folks in a community feel like they can do, even though they know they're being exposed or starting to learn that they're being exposed to things that may be harming their health.
By my count, there are about 15 stories you guys are planning on doing over the next month and a little bit. So, Julie, you start with a trip to Clairton, which is home to the county's largest source of pollution. What did you find when you went there?
Yeah, we wanted to look at U.S. Steel's Clairton Coke Works, the coke plant there. And as you mentioned, it's a large polluter. It's also a low-income community. There's a strong history there, people who have lived there for a number of generations, and people feel very connected there. But there are more than, say, I think 1,100 jobs associated with the plant. I wound up meeting a lot of people, especially people who have been attending some air quality meetings that have been happening there, who are starting to make these connections. They're seeing family members, a lot of people they know getting diseases, a lot of cancer. I was hearing a lot of people say they knew people with cancer, people in their family who had died of cancer, and starting to think, is this connected to the pollution that's coming from the plant? And so we started looking into that. What is the evidence for that at this point?
And I think you have a soundbite that we can play.
We ran them out of here
because
the mill was the best job in town. So how are you going to tell us? We live in it. You go up in Upper St. Clair and you keep living like you living, and we're going to stay right here because as long as there's smoke, this was the argument I'm telling you we had, as long as there's smoke coming from them meals, we're eating, we're drinking, and we're driving good, and we're sending kids to college, and we thought that was all right.
And Julie, I assume that's not the only person that said that type of an idea? Maybe we lost Julie.
Pardon
just...
me?
I said, Julie, I assume that that's not the only person that had that thought.
No. And if you look at our website, we put up a number of interviews with people who we spoke with who have similar kinds of situations where they grew up there and depended, their families depended on that plant for work. And they felt like, pollution, you smoke or steam coming out of the mill, as they call it, meant people had jobs, meant that they had food on the table, that they had good cars to drive, that they were sending their kids to college. And then, they didn't want to, and many people still don't want to hear that the plant is a problem that's causing health issues.
So, Julie, in this series, you spend a lot of time talking about coke plants. What for those who haven't grown up here and might not know what this is, what is a coke plant, and why is there so much pollution associated with it?
Actually, Reed, do you want to answer that one? I think you have I've been reading some of your reporting on this.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's coke is indispensable. It's in making steel, and it's basically it's baked coal, and so it's coal that's heated up without any oxygen in it so that it doesn't burn. And when you do that, it just releases all of the sort of, you know, toxins, basically, that's native to the coal. And, you know, U.S. Steel has spent a lot of money trying to clean up the Clairton Coke Work. It's the biggest coke plant in North America. So it's a major, major facility.
So, Reed, you're an expert on coke, but you're also becoming quite an expert on the natural gas industry with your reporting that you've done for the Allegheny Front over the years. Tell me about the work that you're doing for this series.
Yeah, so one of the interesting stories that I've been following up on is kind of this idea about environmental health near natural gas. You know, we've heard from a lot of environmentalists and public health advocates that they're worried about fracking near communities, near children, et cetera, asthma, et cetera. And there has been some epidemiology that's come out in the last, I don't know, 2 years or so that shows correlations between some bad public health outcomes like premature birth weight, for instance, and proximity to gas wells. And so we can't say for sure what's causing it. It looks like there's some sort of correlation between the two. And so one of the more interesting studies that I'm looking at is a guy actually in University of West Virginia. I just talked to him yesterday, Mike McCauley. He's wondering whether is the problem from fracking itself or is it from something else, like something that we know causes detrimental health effects, truck traffic and diesel emissions. And if you look at it, these well pads do need thousands of truck trips in some instances. And and we know, we just have like lots of evidence that diesel emissions are bad for you. So this is sort of like almost a counterintuitive, is it not, you know, is the problem really something that we've just been staring at the whole time rather than some new exotic foreign thing like fracking? Is that the problem?
So, Reed, you know, just kind of pulling back the veil or the sausage making, whatever the case may be, how do you, as a reporter, be able to at simultaneously step back and get that 40,000-foot level view, which you have to see patterns, but then still drill down to those specific examples?
Well, I think you kind of, you try not to, you know, take anecdotal evidence as sort of the only thing that you use in your reporting. So, like with the Mike McCauley, with this diesel emissions report, I'm going to be looking for, you know, concrete examples. Are there places where this is a problem for people? And what does that look like on the ground? So, you know, that's something that I'm following up on right now. And also, you really want to, like, fact check these people. They do peer review on all these studies, but you want to kind of bounce these ideas around and see what other people think. Maybe they're overinflating their argument about something. So it's just like a combination of trying to flesh it out and see what all kinds of people think about these ideas.
And if I could chime in just to say, for example, with the story with Clairton, you're having people concerned about air quality or air pollution causing cancers. But is that really accurate? When we spoke with the health department, you know, they say it's really hard to pinpoint one pollution source, especially in a community where, as we heard, you have, they had a survey that just came out in the last week that kind of backed up this, that, smoking rates in Clairton and in other areas where there are high-scale emissions, you often have high smoking rates, high obesity rates. In Clairton, there's no grocery store, so it's hard for people to get there, maybe hard to eat healthy. There's all kind of high diabetes rates there. So it may be high. And so you can look at all the statistics and also see, the health surveys and see that, the stats back that up, that in those communities, they do have higher rates of those other things as well. And, you know, and again, there are researchers around Pittsburgh who are looking into these kinds of things and trying to see, for example, are there higher hypertension rates in areas close to smokestacks, higher asthma rates, which, yes, they have, you know, one researcher has found that, yeah, there are higher asthma rates near smokestacks in Clairton, near Ben Avon, I think was the community, excuse me if I'm misspeaking there, but places close to coke plants did find that children had higher asthma rates. So those are other ways of just finding out what research is being done and making sure you see at least what we know at this point, and can we really make these connections between what's happening in the environment and people's health.
And Reid, one of your stories talks about where the Environmental Justice Program and where natural gas productions come together and don't come together. First of all, what is the Environmental Justice Program and what did you learn?
Yeah, the Environmental Justice Program is, well, first of all, the concept is environmental justice is our point sources for pollution, you know, big factories, landfills, toxic waste sites. Are we putting them, are we siting them disproportionately in areas where people are poor or the community is mostly minorities? The state has a program that sort of sets some limits on or some sort of targets. So if you're 20% of your community is above below the poverty line, or it's 30% minority, then that's considered an environmental justice zone. And that what happens is if you're going to put certain kinds of facilities inside that zone or in that neighborhood, it triggers more of more scrutiny, more things like public meetings so that the community can find out more about what that particular industry wants to do. And so the state is actually, in the last couple of years, the state DEP has said that it's trying to reconstitute the program and take a look at whether or not it's really addressing the needs of people around the state. One of the issues is that fracking, oil and gas, is not part of the environmental justice program. So if you want to put a gas well in one of these areas, you won't trigger any increased scrutiny. Now, the one thing to mention is, only about 5% of wells that have been put in these zones that are technically environmental justice areas. So the state's looking at that, see if that's a right, if it should add oil and gas, or if it should change the parameters for what it defines as an environmental justice area.
The series is Hazardous to Your Health, and it launches Saturday morning on the Allegheny Front at 7:30 right here on 90.5 WESA. It runs through July 8th, and it will be available online at AlleghenyFront.org. We should note that the series is supported by the Pittsburgh Foundation, which also supports this radio station. Julie Grant, and Reid Frazier, thank you so very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mark.
Coming up, should Johnstown continue to put fluoride in its water? And what's the deal with the catfish? That's coming up when the Confluence continues on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, industrialist George Westinghouse gives his workers a half day on Saturday, creating what many believe was the first weekend. There was no TGIF 136 years ago, but he did encourage his employees to spend time pursuing their interests. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for June 2nd, 2017.
It's the Confluence, where the news comes together. I'm Mark Newtbar in for Kevin Gavin. The Centers for Disease Control named community fluoridation one of the 10 great public health achievements of the 20th century. For 70 years, the chemical has been added to water supplies across the country, which the CDC says has led to better dental health. It says drinking fluoridated water keeps teeth strong and reduces cavities by about 25%. But it's not cheap to add fluoride, and that's where the debate begins in Johnstown. Joining me on the phone is Johnstown Tribune Democrat reporter Dave Suter. Thanks for joining us on the Confluence, Dave.
Oh, thanks for the invitation. I appreciate the opportunity.
Great. Dave, let's start out with the basics. What is the Greater Johnstown Water Authority actually proposing here?
What they're proposing is that they want to eliminate fluoride from the drinking water supply. And the reason that came about was that in order to move forward with the program, they figure over the next 10 years, they would have to spend about $400,000 to $500,000. And that would include a $125,000 capital improvement program to the chemical feed system, and then also include the cost of fluoride over the following years. So they're looking at this as a potential cost-saving measure by eliminating that $400,000 to $500,000. And their goal would be to have that money and use it for other ways to improve the water supply.
So they're already adding the fluoride, obviously, right now. The system, is it just old?
Yes, yeah, and it's just something that needs upgraded. And then, like I said, also they're looking at that, and what I've been told is that it's the one chemical they put in that doesn't directly relate to treating the water and making the water better. So they looked at it as a possibility of something that could be eliminated going forward.
So the one thing that doesn't make it so that you would get sick if you're drinking the water.
Exactly.
Now, the authority held a hearing on the idea this week. I'm sure there was a consensus among all the speakers, right?
Not quite, but I will say that it was a very even-toned, polite discussion. I'd say only about one person really kind of drifted off into some areas that weren't productive, but it was split right down the middle. There were about two dozen speakers, and I think on my final tally, I had one more person speaking in favor of keeping the fluoride than was against it. But it was really a pretty good discussion. Everybody was citing studies, a lot of scientific-based evidence that they were giving. It actually left feeling that it was a productive discussion, and it did give the authority some ideas about what people in the community are thinking without going into any hostilities or things along those lines.
Now, in a nutshell, what are the arguments to keep fluoride?
Basically, that there were at least two dentists who spoke and said this shows the fluoride helps prevent tooth decay, and Johnstown is a poor community. In the city itself, one-third of the population lives in poverty. Now, the authority covers different municipalities around the city also, but still, there's a high rate of poverty around there, and part of their argument was saying these might be people who can't otherwise afford to get quality dental care, so we can have this in the water and at least give them that benefit of the fluoride, and not to mention everybody else in the community. That was the argument for keeping it.
But we're talking a few $100,000, right? How many customers?
22,000. So that was an argument that they presented also, saying this is only going to cost you every customer pennies a month to keep this. So they were saying, yes, I'll put my nickel into that pot for this, to have the fluoride for everybody. The water authorities point on that, they said you can't just look at that in that way. You have to look at it as like this, here's this $500,000 lump of cash that we could be using for something else. So yeah, there was some discussion about that versus is it pennies per person or $500,000 in your hand. So trying to figure out that was part of the issue.
So other than the financial argument, are there other arguments against the fluoride?
Yes, a lot of people who spoke in favor of not putting fluoride in the water anymore, a lot of them really stuck to the idea of people that's used for medical purposes. So they were saying, don't medicate me without my consent, even if it's for something like this. A couple of people said, if I want it, I'll go get the tablets. I can do fluoride myself if I want to. Don't put in our drinking water where everybody's exposed to it if they don't want to be and might not necessarily even know it's there.
The debate over fluoride has been going on since really not long after it was first introduced. Maybe 50 years people have been talking about this. It's just kind of been bubbling in the background. No pun intended there. did these arguments about fluoride, surprise you as a reporter?
No, I had known a little bit about the issue on site, just the general idea of both sides of the issue and what some of the thoughts were. I got a crash course in this over the last week, and there appears to be some very passionate people on both sides of this issue who have filled my inbox and my voicemail and my tweets and everything about trying to, show me why their opinion is best on this and that the other side is, wrong. But not much locally. Locally, it was a positive response about saying, hey, you know, good for presenting the issue and it's good to have the discussion. Most of that kind of response seemed to come from outside our area of people who got the opinion, track this issue very closely, and anytime they see anything about it are kind of vocal about their opinions.
Yeah, it's interesting. This is coming up in Meadville right now, talking about the water supply there. I guess that vote is coming up later this month. Just in the last 5 years, Ford City has talked about this. Ligonier has talked about this, and Shaler in 2003. So there is some movement here, at least in this region. So tell me, when it comes to Johnstown, what's next?
The Water Authority is expected to vote on this sometime this summer. I don't think they're going to be able to get their next meeting because they did leave the public comment portion open. You know, if you still want to comment and offer your opinion, that's still open. You can contact the Water Authority, and I don't think they'll think that'll be complete and that they'll have all the information they want for the next meeting. So I'm expecting 2 meetings from now there to be a vote on this. But, of course, you know, municipal governments and everything, that could change any minute, something you get moved down the line or things like that. But I think that's probably the target they're aiming for.
Well, Dave, thanks for doing all the reporting, and thanks for joining me today.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate the chance to talk.
That was Dave Suter. He's a writer for the Johnstown Tribune Democrat, and he's been following the debate over a proposal to stop adding fluoride to Johnstown's drinking water supply. From drinking water to a frozen pond, the Penguins are 2 games up on the Predators of Nashville in the Stanley Cup Finals. It's rare that PETA would comment on the series, but they have because a catfish made an on-ice appearance. In a letter to the Penguins CEO, the group said, "Thank you for taking swift action that will remind all sports fans that this offensive behavior will not be tolerated." Joining me now is Upgroove writer Rob Rossi. Rob, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Now, for the uninitiated, what's the deal with the catfish?
Well, you know, it's a delicacy down here in Nashville. It's quite a popular dish. And the hockey tradition dates to Detroit of throwing a squid, what they call an octopus, on the ice at a random point in games. That's now done in Nashville at times, and I think the Penguins are trying to have some fun with them, or Penguin fans, excuse me. This isn't the first time that PETA has penned a letter to the Penguins this year. They did it after a game that was played at Heinz Field in, I think it was February, when the Penguins had Penguins from the National Aviary on the ice, and they said that was cruel treatment of the Penguins. So, you know, PETA and the Penguins have had sort of a love-hate relationship this year, much like a lot of the teams the Penguins play.
Just not usually what a sports reporter has to talk about. Now, here's what the pesca propeller had to say about his decision to throw that catfish.
It was just a dumb redneck with a bad idea, but it's turned into all this.
That was Jake Waddell speaking on a Nashville radio station, WGFX. Well, Rob, you're down in Nashville right now. What's the scene like?
There's a very good, what we would call in the sports world, buzz in the city right now. This is their first Stanley Cup final game. They had never been past the second round prior to this year. And, you know, this is a city that is still relatively new to professional sports. You got to remember, it's only about 20 years ago that the Tennessee Titans of the NFL relocated to Nashville from Houston. This is the Predators' first chance at a championship. They've been a great home team. It's a very young audience in Nashville. They, much like Pittsburgh, wears the gold at home. That's their primary color down here. So they deck out in gold. They play in what we call a rickety old arena, the Bridgestone Coliseum, because it's really a music auditorium. So it has great acoustics, and there's all kind of talk about the game tomorrow night, Saturday, excuse me, and how it will be bedlam down here, and they're beefing up security around the city to just make sure everybody can stay safe, because as big as the crowds have been for the previous rounds, they're expecting it to be much larger tonight, or Saturday night, excuse me.
Now, I know it's early, but have you seen much black and gold down there, or found a Steeler bar or two?
There is a Steeler bar down here. There's a Steeler bar everywhere. I'm pretty sure there's one in North Korea if we could get in. But there are Penguin fans coming down. Now, the difference between, I think, the games in Nashville and the games that were played in Pittsburgh is last year they were playing those games in Pittsburgh, the Stanley Cup Final. So Pittsburgh fans have spent a lot of money in the previous year to get into the championship round. Nashville fans, this is an interesting note, their season ticket holders are not permitted to buy tickets for all games of the Stanley Cup final. What they do is stagger them. So you're only, I think they do it for three. So a third of their fan base can buy tickets for game three, a third for game four, and a third for game six if necessary. And then they make a lot more tickets available to the general public. Those are already gone, and those are going for, the cheapest I've seen seats going for, believe it or not, is over $10,000 right now. So that might change if the Predators lose game three for game four. So I think there are some Pittsburghers planning to see how that goes tomorrow night, and then to see if they want to make the drive down Sunday to see the Penguins possibly win the cup again.
That's a pretty big chunk of change. You mentioned the Detroit Octopus throwing. The Florida Panthers had rubber rats. There was actually a time when hamburgers were thrown on the ice up in Canada. Why doesn't Pittsburgh have something cool like that? Or annoying, whichever side you land
on. Well, look, Pittsburgh has many annoying things they do with sports. But I think the Pittsburghers, it's just a different type of culture. They're not afraid to throw things. They threw trash on the ice in the previous round when they were unhappy with the calls, but they don't usually do it for no reason. There was a famous incident where Pittsburghers launched, I believe it was batteries at a former Steelers quarterback when he returned with the USFL. So I guess I should say that's an infamous incident. I think Pittsburghers are generally more content to just bring towels to a game, whether it's the terrible towel or what the Penguins call the tuxedo towel, a gold towel that they wave around. I think that's more Pittsburgh's things. Maybe they need to work on their arm strength.
Now, despite all of the talk of catfish and other paraphernalia, there's actually a game going on. So let's chat about that for just a quick moment. Pecorine, the goalie for the Predators, nearly perfect.
Great
against
pronunciation of his name. You got it right.
All right. Hey, he was nearly perfect against the Blackhawks in the first round. Since then, he's been slipping. What are you seeing?
Well, look, I think there's a lot of reasons to think the Nashville Predators are going to put up a fight still in this series. But they're not going to take the Stanley Cup away from the Pittsburgh Penguins unless Pecorine really reestablishes the form he had in the Chicago series, which was, you know, over a month and a half ago. To my eyes, and I've covered the NHL for 12 years now, he's going down far too early. He's over-aggressive on shots. The Penguins are taking advantage of that. That's why they've been able to beat him without a high shot total in this series. They have a real problem in Nashville. I'm not sure that even if he starts in game three, that Peter Laviolette, a coach who's been, this is his third final now, I would have guessed that even if he starts in game three, if Verini gives up a shaky goal early, you're going to see Nashville's backup goaltender. And if that happens, that's probably the worst sign for the Predators fans down here.
I think that's a pretty bold prediction. In 60 seconds, give me a little historical perspective. You've been covering for the NHL for a while. Penguins have won back-to-back titles. It used to be almost the norm in the NHL, but it has become exceedingly uncommon, right?
Right. So history for the National Hockey League, a win by the Penguins in this series would elevate Sidney Crosby to within the top five all-time of NHL players. It would give him his third championship. If, as I would expect, of getting Malkin completes the postseason as the leading scorer and wins a second playoff MVP, it puts him in the conversation of the greatest Russian National Hockey League players of all time, given his individual accomplishments. And think about this. Just in Pittsburgh, if the Penguins would win this series in 25 years, so a quarter of a century, they would have matched the championships that it has taken the Pirates almost 120 years to win. This victory would give the Penguins a fifth world championship, which would be second only to the Steelers, and it would be the most by any NHL franchise other than the Edmonton Oilers since the 1980 season, and they would be even with Edmonton. So it would be a franchise-altering victory if they can get this final championship.
Rob, thank you so very much for your time. That's all the time we have for today for The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. The engineer for the program is Tom Hurley, production assistance from Katie Blackley. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Mark Neutbar. Kevin will be back with you next week. Until then, have a great day and a wonderful weekend.